The end. The end. Right? Do you guys remember a few weeks back I started off a sermon with once upon a time? And you guys were all waiting on me to like finish the story. Well, today I'm starting off with the end. Okay?
Okay.
Because every story has an end, right? We'll get to that. Some ends, though, are different than others, aren't they? Like, remember when we watched Cinderella and they said the end, it was preceded by and they lived happily ever after the end. So you knew that that end was actually a happily ever after. But then there are other endings like a book I just read. Well, I wouldn't say just read, probably in the past few years. Some of you might have heard of it. They made a movie about it called The Fault in Our Stars. It's about two teenagers with cancer who fall in love. And whenever you reach the end of the book, it literally just stops because it's kind of a recording of her journal. And when I reached the end of that book, I was sobbing, you know, like this is, oh, I can't take this. And that's kind of like a modern day Romeo and Juliet, you know, that you might have read in high school, similar to that. But some endings are just disturbing, aren't they? They're jolting and disturbing. They make us sad. They remind us of our own mortality, the brokenness that we live in. And a lot of us don't like to think about death. And that's probably healthy for the most part, right? That we're not thinking about death all the time. But the problem comes when we can't think about death without getting really nervous or going into denial about it. I'll never die. Yeah, that's okay. You're going into denial about death. Or that you have to make deals with God whenever you think about death. Well, I'll promise I'll do this when, if you just let me live a little longer. I'll promise this, God. Or you maybe need to take a substance or drink to forget all the bad things whenever you start thinking about death because you feel so much regret because of all the choices that you've made. And when we have to face the end, because we all will at some point, what will that be like? And will our end be like everyone else up to this point, where we take our last breath and our bodies are laid in the ground, or will our end be different? We're going to talk about that today. Because as you know, as Christians, we're waiting on Christ to return, his second coming. And we're going to learn straight from Jesus today in Matthew 24 and 25 what we need to know before that moment gets here. Whether that means the end is when we take our last breath and our body is laid in the earth, or whether the end is whenever he returns. Whatever end that is. And I had to pause here. I had a note here to pause just to make sure that Jesus didn't come back, right? That is how aware we need to be that Jesus could come back any moment. Jesus is going to talk about that today. But it's 10:15, I don't know what time it is, 10:26 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and Jesus has not come back yet. And so we have more to do, more to learn, more to serve, more to watch for, more to look forward to. So let's read what Jesus wanted us to know before the end comes, whatever end that is. And so we're going to start reading in Matthew 24. We're going to read most of 24. 25, I'm going to condense a little bit, but we're going to read most of 24. So 24:1, Jesus left the temple. And you remember, this is him he's in Jerusalem now. He's come into Jerusalem. So he's at the temple where the Jews believe that God's spirit resided in the Holy of Holies. And he was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." So it'd be like, you know, if you went to tour New York and somebody was pointing out all the tall buildings, being like, "Isn't that amazing? And isn't that impressive?" And Jesus being like, "It's all going to fall. It's all coming down. Everyone will be thrown down." So as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. Okay. For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. In other words, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to try to teach you a lot of things that are going to go against what is in Scripture. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of the birth pains. Okay? Did I go to the next one? Oh, I did. Okay. The beginning of the birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. And at that time, many will turn away from the faith. By the way, that's called apostasy. I just learned that word this week. So when you hear the word apostasy, it's people who have believed, but they turn away from the faith. And will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. The love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end, see that? The end, will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Okay, so let's stop for a minute. Jesus is laying down some pretty heavy stuff, right? Cataclysmic stuff. Famines, earthquakes, wars, persecution, hate, martyrdom, love growing cold. I mean, it's one bad thing after another. And now, 2,000 years later, from when Jesus made that statement, we can see the truth of his prophecy, right? Famines, wars, persecution, martyrdom. Every single thing that he listed has been true in the world. So the temple was actually demolished. Remember how he said every stone will be thrown down? The temple in Jerusalem was demolished in the year 70 AD. So about 40 years after Jesus passed away and then rose again. Let's say that clearly. And we're going to talk more about that event in just a minute. But the temple was completely destroyed 40 years after Jesus made this prediction. So why would Jesus tell the disciples all this heavy stuff? It's kind of depressing, isn't it? when I'm taking my kids, I was thinking about it like this. Whenever I take my kids to get vaccinations and they ask, well, what's it going to be like? You know, they're a little freaked out. What's it going to be like when I get a shot? And I don't say, well, it's going to be bad. Like, take what you're thinking and multiply it by 10. And that's what it's going to feel like. And when they push that plunger into you, it's going to feel like it's going into your soul. But don't worry, you'll survive. We don't do that, right? That's kind of like what Jesus did here. Because they were like, you know, when's the end coming? They're a little, you know, excited trying to figure this out. And Jesus is like, it's going to be bad. And so we might think he's not being very loving by, you know, oh my goodness, he's telling us all these bad things that are coming. He's not being very hopeful and encouraging, talking about being killed for believing in him. Why did he need to communicate the bad and horrible stuff that was coming even to those who believed in him? In fact, especially because of those who believed in him, right? Because Jesus is talking about something that's far more intricate than a single shot, right? He's talking about, he knew the time span, right? He's talking about the intricacy of the birthing process that he's talking about. I remember whenever I was pregnant and giving in labor, right? It's a painful, long process. And if you go into it thinking this is going to be done and over like a vaccination, oh, that's bad. You have to be aware of what's coming. And so it was generosity that Jesus gave the disciples, gave us an insight into what was going to happen. It was generosity. Jesus knew the depth of depravity that exists in the world. He knew it. The horrible atrocities that were coming, the death and the murder of his disciples. We needed to know so we could endure to the end, right? I like that because a lot of ministries and preachers today will tell you about all the good and wonderful things, but they don't say things like Jesus said, that this is hard. You got to count the cost. You've got to choose me over all the stuff that you actually want to do. And in fact, whenever you do choose me, you're going to be persecuted for it. The world is not going to like it. The enemy will come against you. However, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. That it is that testimony that we gain from choosing Jesus that overcomes the world. And so it might be hard in the middle of it in a way, but in another way, it's way easier. Because at least you know you're following the one who's eternal. Not just stuck in the misery of the world. And so from the time that Jesus spoke this, and actually beginning with Jesus himself, millions of Christians have been killed for their faith through the centuries, millions. But no blade, no bullet, no noose, whatever was used to kill them, could touch their soul, which was safe with God. And most of us nowadays walking around as Christians, we're not in fear of our lives in America, okay? There are definitely places in the world where Christians do walk around in fear for their lives. But when you know that fear, it just makes you more aware of how much you can trust God, because that's what Jesus was doing here. He was saying, you can trust me. I know what is coming. And I am going to be with you through all of it. It's actually what we're supposed to be reaching towards every moment of every day, trusting in the sovereignty. That's what it's called, the sovereignty, the ruling of God. And so Jesus wanted to give this advance warning so he could encourage this trust in God, regardless of the circumstances, no matter who comes at us, who resists the message of the kingdom, or how our circumstances plague our efforts, that Jesus is Lord. And we are safe in him, no matter what. Okay, so before we keep reading, there are some things you should know, okay? Where the verses above, almost everyone can agree on the fact that they describe the history that we've seen. You know, we can see the truth of the prophecy that Jesus just spoke. The verses below that we're getting ready to read, many people have many different interpretations on whether or not these prophecies have been fulfilled. Okay? I say that before we start reading because I see a couple of different valid interpretations to what comes next. And to be honest, I haven't landed on any one of them yet. I've got my favorites, right? But I want to put that out there because we do need to be watchful because Jesus told us to be watchful and to know the signs of the times. I know a lot of people who teach we are living in the very end, that Jesus' return is imminent. He's coming back any second. But I also know that faithful people have been teaching that since the first century, that Jesus was coming back. And I think God did that for a reason. Number one, I really think that he did that. He wanted us to know the end is imminent, whether it's our own end that we die or he's coming back. That we need to live with a sense of urgency as Christians, okay? But not a sense of fear of the end, okay? We're going to talk about that more. But if you have an interest in this week in really looking at the prophecy that we're getting ready to read, go back and read Daniel 7 through 12. Because when you read Daniel 7 through 12, it really speaks a lot to what Jesus is getting ready to say. He's actually going to use phrases from Daniel to talk about the end times. Okay, so that's even older prophecy that Jesus is referencing. So let's start reading. Verse 15. Don't worry, we're going to talk about things. I'm going to read it, and then we're going to talk about it, okay? So, when you see standing in the holy place, that would be the center of the temple in Jerusalem, the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation. That's a phrase from Daniel. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Spoken of through the prophet Daniel. Let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. Now, what's interesting is Jesus is talking about a span of time that has a beginning and has an end, and they are actually being shortened. The elect are the people of God, okay? And the other thing you need to know that I just loved as I was reading it, do you notice that Jesus is talking in the past tense about future events? If those days had not been cut short. Isn't that cool? Like, he's already seeing it. It's like, if those days had not been cut short. So you could just see, he's seeing it from an eternal perspective, that he's outside of time. He could see time from beginning to end. And so, most scholars take this section that we just read, and they say that this teaching of Jesus refers to the destruction of the temple. Okay? In 70 AD, that's what most scholars, we're going to talk about what other scholars say in a second, but this was decades after Jesus died. It was still during the time when some of the disciples were living. So that would have made sense with Jesus telling them the destruction of the temple, like, you need to get out whenever you see it happening. Flee to the hills of Judea. Don't go get your cloak. Don't go anywhere. Josephus, who was a historian for Rome, he actually said the destruction of the temple was a time of such severe distress that it was unequaled from the beginning of the world. You remember how Jesus said that? Then I actually didn't know this until I was studying this week. Priests before 70 AD were actually slaughtered in the temple. Human blood was spilled in the temple. And that's what most scholars believe is the abomination that caused the desolation of the temple. Because human blood is an abomination to God. You know, the shedding of human blood, murder. And to do it in the holy place, that means the temple had to be desolated, you know, torn down, which it was in 70 AD. So, most scholars believe that's what this section is talking about. However, some scholars teach these verses occurred when the Dome of the Rock was built on the Temple Mount. You guys know what the Dome of the Rock is. It is a Islamic, what are they called? Mosque. Built now, you can actually see it if you go to Jerusalem these days. It's actually, you've probably seen it in pictures. I should have brought a picture. But it's a mosque sitting on top of the temple ruins of Jerusalem. So some people think that is the abomination that causes desolation. Yet others say that the abomination that causes desolation hasn't occurred yet. You can literally find almost any opinion about the interpretation of these verses. There are a lot of theories. And since Jesus was already referencing the event of the temple being torn down, I tend to side with that one, that it was during the time when the temple was destroyed, that he was giving warning to those people with him. And it's subtle, but Jesus actually transitions here to talk about now when he will return to the about the final end. So if you'll remember, the disciples ask him about three things. I actually pointed them out when I was reading. When will the temple destruction happen? What will be the sign of your coming? And the signs of the end of the age. So that was in verse 3. He's talked about the signs of the end of the age and the temple destruction. And now he moves to what will be the sign of his coming. Okay? I know. Don't worry. I'm going to make sense of all this in a little bit. Okay? So this is often called the second coming of Christ. So let's start reading. Verse 23. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. Okay? I always think of Joseph Smith whenever I hear this. He's the guy who started Mormonism because he said he was the last prophet, the one who would fill in the gaps in the Bible. Don't believe it, okay? For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform, listen to this, they will perform great signs and wonders, okay? To deceive, if possible, even the elect, the people of God. See, I have told you ahead of time. We don't have to be worried that we're going to miss Jesus coming back. It's not a fear that we have to have, or that we're not following the right person on this earth, okay? Because Jesus says he's the one. We don't have to worry about anybody else. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the wilderness, do not go out, or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. That's what Jesus calls himself, okay? Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. In other words, it's going to be very clear. We're going to know when he comes back. We don't have to worry about that. Immediately after the distress of those days, so in other words, whenever Jesus does come back, it'll be very distressing for a lot of people, okay? It will be, because they're going to realize, oh goodness, all of this was true, and I've denied him as Lord of my life. So immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels out with a loud trumpet call. And they will gather his elect from the four winds. That just means from the four corners of the earth. Okay, and from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. And I love how he talks about summer, right? The fullness of God reigning on earth. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Now, that's an interesting sentence, right? Because you're like, hold on a second, Jesus. You were talking to people who are right in front of you. How can you say that this, will happen in their generation? And there are two thoughts on this. One is that Jesus isn't talking about the generation that's sitting in front of him. He's talking about the generation who's alive at the time of his second coming. In other words, that whenever he comes, it's all going to happen quickly within the lifetime of the people that are alive, okay? Which makes sense in the context. I tend to prefer that reading. Some other people say that this sentence references back to when he was talking about the destruction of the temple, okay? That this will occur when this generation is alive, but, this generation will certainly not pass away until then. However, Jesus is finished up with, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Okay? So the big ideas from what we just read, for those who are in Christ, we don't have to worry that we're going to miss something or that we're not going to be in the right place at the right time. Okay? We don't have to travel around the world looking for him. We don't have to travel to Jerusalem. It's great if you can, but you don't have to. Muslims, by the way, are required to visit Mecca and Medina at least once in their lifetimes, or they're not good Muslims and they won't go to heaven. Okay? This will be an event the whole world will know about. I like how Jesus says, see, I have told you ahead of time. He doesn't do that a lot. Jesus doesn't share a lot about what's coming, but he does in this specific section. We don't get this assurance a lot in life either, right? We don't know what's coming down the road, or we get surprised by circumstances. And remember what I said about a lot of people teaching that even first century Christians were teaching Jesus would come back in their lifetime, right? So let's keep reading. But about that day,
or hour,
no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Interestingly, about this little, where is it? Nor the Son. That little clause right there is found in some manuscripts and not found in others. And the way the commentators talk about that is they say that Jesus might have withheld that information from himself while he was on the earth because he was already limiting his powers as God, right, by being in a human bodily form. But it could be that, in any way, there's some discussion there about that clause being in there. But as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. So, two things here. Noah is referenced as a way to show that no one was prepared. You know, in the days of Noah, they were living their lives right up to the point of the destructive flood. In the same way, when Jesus returns, people will be going through Starbucks lines, right? If there are still Starbucks around, they'll be watching TV, playing video games, or flipping burgers, right? That might be veggie burgers 50 years into the future. Who knows? But the second thing is, Jesus states that some people will be taken and some will be left. He made that very clear in what we just read. Okay? And this is where scholars find justification for the word rapture. Okay? Anybody ever heard the word rapture? Yeah. Okay. We're going to talk about this word. It's actually derived from 1 Thessalonians 4:17. It means to be caught up, seized, or snatched away. Okay? Now, I know when many of you hear that word, your ears kind of perk up a little bit, right? We even have people with bumper stickers. In case of rapture, this car will be evacuated, you know, or will not have a driver. I can't remember exactly how it says it. Oh, this car will be unoccupied. There we go. Yeah. So, there are a lot of TV evangelists who actually capture in on this curiosity that we have with end times, because we do. We have a curiosity about it. Most people do. Not everybody. They have rapture teachings and charts and calculations and astrological arrangements showing that they know when the end is coming. You'll often see in the news people saying, I've got a date. On this day, some guy did it just a couple years back, in September, whatever day it was, the world will end, okay? What does Jesus tell us? Nobody knows, okay? So don't get fearful whenever you hear that. Now, if it does increase in you that remembrance, Jesus might come back today, tomorrow. I might die today, tomorrow. And that helps you live in a way that is more faithful. Then you can use that, but don't let it let you live in a way that you're more fearful or that you start holding up and isolating yourselves, okay? Because that's not what Jesus wants us to do at all. So, as I was researching all of this, I can't tell you how many different things I read about this and the commentaries that are out there. I actually have a chart for you. This is what I was saying. I'm going to put all this together. Don't worry, it won't be understandable yet, but I'll show you my last thing. I actually have a chart of the current leading theories of the end time. I know you cannot see this, but you essentially need to know that there are four different schools of thought on the end time. I love these names. Post-tribulational premillennialism, pre-tribulational dispensational premillennialism, post-millennialism, and amillennialism. Okay. I know, it's a mouthful. I was like, whole snap. And I liked how this was actually from Wikipedia, but it's a really good chart of what people believe, when it's going to happen, when it's not going to happen. And just to let you know, this is very simplified, because even within each block, like for example, this one, There are even three different teachings within that one about when it's going to happen. Okay, so like I said, people would have put a lot of energy and time and thought into this. And the other thing I want to point out is I'm not making fun of people studying this. I'm really not. I think it's amazing that people pore over the scripture to really seek out and search what Jesus has to say. And I want to point out, these are some people who are associated with these specific teachings. I want you to read through that list and see that they're in different camps. John Piper, John MacArthur, David Jeremiah, Jonathan Edwards. And then this one down here is a pretty interesting block. Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Anglican, Mainline Protestant, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian. Okay? And so just looking at this chart, you can tell that there are faithful people in each block, right? What we would consider some faithful people who have taught the Word of God. And yet they believe very different things about when Jesus will return. And so people way more educated than I am can't agree on this, okay? Because we just don't know the particulars yet, right? We can have a general outline, right? We have a general outline that's clear. But the exact timing and the exact way that things are going to happen are left to God's realm of knowledge. He gives us just enough insight to know it's coming. It's coming. And we need to be watchful for it. We need to be aware of the signs. We don't need to be frustrated or feel fearful. But we need to have a sense of urgency about our lives. And that's where Jesus goes now, because he's not giving particulars, but general indicators. And here is why. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Truly I tell you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, "My master is staying away a long time." And he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And no, it was not a Jewish thing to cut people into pieces. Jesus was using hyperbole again to show it's bad. It's bad whenever you get caught not doing what the master has told you to do. And I've always thought about it like this. So, what would it feel like if Jesus came back the moment that I was indulging my own sinfulness? What would that feel like? Like if he came back while I was in the middle of a gossip session? What if he came back while I was watching unsavory things on my phone or TV? What if he came back and I was cheating on my taxes, having an affair, or withholding aid from someone who needed help? Right? But then I think that is what Jesus is saying here. He isn't saying it to make us only out of, he isn't saying it to make us obey only out of fear of being caught. Right? That's not what he's saying. He's saying it because he wants his household to be well cared for. Did you catch that in verse 45? The faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in the household to give them their food at the proper time. If we're indulging our sinfulness, we're not taking care of others. If we're indulging our sinfulness, we're not serving the church. If we're indulging our sinfulness, then we're not looking in for ways that we can bring others the love of Christ. In fact, we get very selfishly focused, don't we? And so that we are his bodily presence on earth, the body of Christ. And so Christ's body shouldn't be spending time watching porn or having emotional affairs. Christ's body shouldn't be cussing out the driver in front of them. Christ's body shouldn't be egregiously overeating or overspending while others starve and remain homeless. I know I'm hitting some buttons here because I was hitting my own buttons when I was writing it. Christ's body has way better things to be doing on this earth than fulfilling our selfish desires and making sure we're safe. I'm safe. Everybody else can just go to hell if that's what they want to do. That's what we're saying whenever we refuse to share the love of God with others and indulge our sinful desires. And I know that that is heavy, and it should be heavy, because we've been given a great responsibility. And Jesus is going to talk about that here in a second. Our fear shouldn't be of getting caught. It's not our fear. Our fear should be that we aren't stewarding well that God, what God has given us. That we aren't stewarding it well. And so the way to live in the light of the gospel is to think about all the ways we can love God and love others. That's what our thoughts should be on. How can I love God and how can I love others? What does that look like in my life? Because it's going to look really different for all of us, because we're at very different places in life, different jobs, different cares that we have, different people that we're serving. And so I always think of the verse Philippians 4:8, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Because I've noticed my own tendency that whenever I try to be like, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do it, and that's all I think about, not doing it, it makes me want to do it more, right? Whatever that it is. So God is giving us what we have to be doing is not thinking about what we're not going to be doing. We need to be thinking about the things that he wants us to be doing. Whatever is true, whatever is lovely, whatever is noble, whatever is pure, whatever is right. Okay? That is our what we have been given. Now, like I said, I'm not going to read all of Matthew 25. Jesus actually gives two parables in Matthew 25 to support and display what he just taught in Matthew 24. I'm not going to read them, but I have to mention something about one of them especially. The very first one is called the Parable of the Ten Virgins in most Bibles. Is that what it is? Well, if you've got your Bible open, yeah. Parable of the Ten Virgins. Now, to our modern ears, this parable sounds like a polygamous cult, okay? Parable of the ten Virgins, and they're waiting on a groom that they're going to marry, okay? However, I need to tell you this. This opened my eyes to this parable. In this culture, it was customary for young women, virgins, to be bridesmaids. Bridesmaids. So, whenever you read this parable, don't think 10 virgins, think 10 bridesmaids. They were the ones who came around the bride, and whenever the groom would come to the bride's house to take her back to his father's house, getting this reference here, the bridesmaids would light their lamps and light the way to the father's house. That's pretty cool, isn't it? But if you don't know that, you're like, why is one guy marrying 10 women and only 5 of them actually get to marry him? It's not that, okay? These are the bridesmaids taking the bride. Who's the bride in the Bible? The church. The church is the bride. Jesus is the groom. Okay, so the point of the parable is that the bridesmaids are ready with oil in their lamps. In other words, they prepared ahead of time because they recognize their responsibility and their honor at getting the ones to be able to escort the bride and the groom to their wedding feast. Isn't that beautiful whenever we think about it as a church? Okay, so second parable focuses on what Jesus did or on what servants did in the master's absence with money that he had given them. A master comes and he gives one servant like 10 bags of money, another one 5 bags of money, and another one just 1 bag of money. And they each do different things. The guy with 10 bags goes and actually invests it and does things with it to make a return. You gave me 10 bags, I came back with 20. I'm not quoting the exact numbers, but you get the idea, okay? But you'll notice at the end, the one servant that only got 1 bag, he buried it in the ground. Buried it in the ground. And the master, when he comes back, he's like, you didn't even put it in the safe deposit in the bank so it could earn interest. And I liked how one commentator, he said, this servant simply did not care what happened to the master's property. Didn't care. It kind of looks like he did, right? He buried it in the ground. At least it was safe, right? But the master's like, no, it wasn't even accruing interest like it should have been. You didn't care about my property. And you'll notice at the end of the parable, the servant was thrown outside into darkness, similar to what we just read. And I liked it how one of my commentaries summarized this for us today. Being ready for Christ's coming involves more than playing it safe and doing little or nothing. It's more than that. We're not just supposed to get saved and bury ourselves in the ground, okay? There's a lot of stuff that's supposed to happen in between that. It demands the kind of service that produces results. Okay, so if we are into the cozy discipling culture, then I just come and I get fed at church and then I go out and, you know, I do some things. I do my job. That's not enough. It's not enough whenever we bury our things. And so that's why we're here at the church, to encourage each other in our gifts. How are we gifted? Do you know your spiritual gifts? How are you using them? It doesn't have to specifically be in a ministry within these four walls. It could be, I hope it's outside of these four walls, that you're applying your gifts. If it's the stranger at Walmart, if it's your family, whomever it is, that you're showing other God's love and using your gifts. And by the way, if you are a Christian, you have spiritual gifts. Okay? You can't claim, I don't have anything, you know. Jesus gave me no bags, all right? I've got nothing, all right? You can't claim that. Not true. That's just a lie you're telling yourself to keep yourself from doing what God is actually wanting you to do. You're in denial, okay? So if you need help discerning your spiritual gifts, you got a whole room of people who could probably get you started on that process. You can take those little tests online. I like it better with the people that you're actually interacting with, because they're around you. That's one of the reasons why the church is a body together, because we can encourage each other's gifts and build each other up. And if you notice something in somebody else, tell them, I noticed you're really good at fill in the blank. That's what Amanda does actually with the children's thing. She'll always say to them, I see in you. And she fills in the blank. Just speaks it into their life. I see in you a real gift of prayer. I see in you a gift of mercy. A gift of hospitality. A gift of encouragement. That's what being the church is about. And so Jesus does these two parables. Like I said, you can go back and read them this week if you like. Now knowing that it's bridesmaids. Okay. And we come to the final section in chapter 25. After all this discussion of the end times, I pray that I haven't confused you this morning, because I have to admit, I felt a little confused myself after doing all the research and study this week. But the big point you should walk away with is we should be ready in any moment. Any moment. And if we're not, we need to deal with that immediately. Immediately. Just like the bridesmaids, we need to be looking forward to it, even with our lamps ready, right? And our lives being put to good use, like the servant, right? So let's read about Jesus's final insight into what the very end will be like, regardless of when all this occurs, because nobody knows, right? Regardless of when it occurs, this is what the very end will be like. This is verse 31 in chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, He will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, remember that's where the sheep are, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. Oh, did I go to the next one? The king will reply. Oh, no, I lost my place again. Here we go. The king will reply. Oh, I'm just going to read off the screen. Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me. They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick and in prison and did not help you? He will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. So you know those sayings that start off, there are only two kinds of people in the world. Sometimes it's a joke, you know, or there are only two kinds of people in the world. Well, Jesus started it. And he's going to end it, right? There are only two types of people in the world. Among all the nations, tribes, and languages through all geography and space, just two. And you'll notice the king doesn't just say, come, you who are blessed by my Father. He also mentions the deeds that they do with their fellow human beings. Doesn't he? You didn't give me anything to eat or anything to drink. You didn't take care of me whenever I was a stranger. All those people, which is every single one of us, who were made in the image of God, you did not take care of them while I was away. Okay? Our works don't save us. Let's be very clear about this. Our works do not save us, but they sure do reveal the posture of our hearts. Because if we have a loving heart like God, then we are going to love people. Are we headstrong and stubborn like a goat? Butting our heads against whatever doesn't go our way? Or are we in the fold, eating in the pastures of the shepherd and providing wool for others to keep warm? If anything is clear from all that we learn that Jesus taught us today, it's that we shouldn't wait until the end to know the everlasting.